Blog Talk Radio.
Good Sunday afternoon. It's 12 p.m. Eastern Time in the U.S., and that means it's time for another edition of Making Sense with Steve Laser. I'm your host, Steve Laser, and I thank you for deciding to spend part of your afternoon with me. So we're 5 days after Election Day 2012, and the dust is starting to clear. Of course, President Obama has won re-election. Democrats have held the Senate, picking up two additional Senate seats in the process. And Democrats also picked up a few seats in the House of Representatives. Republicans are starting to react to their beatdown, and their reaction's pretty interesting. We're going to cover that and the continued problems with reality that Republicans have. That's going to account for a lot of our news for the week. Then we're going to talk about Benghazi and how Republicans are trying to politicize that tragedy. And we'll have our first Hall of Fame and Shame since Election Day, listing those politicians and pundits who particularly made sense or nonsense, respectively. At any time during the show, if you want to call in and talk with me, please do so. The call-in number for the show is 917-889-3891. Let's get to it. We have continued analysis of Republican reaction to their defeat in election 2012, starting with an immediate flip-flop on immigration reform. So one thing that was not lost on anyone looking at what happened in election 2012 is the historical percentage of the Latino vote garnered by Democrats. Approximately 75% of Latino voters voted for President Obama, and that's cited as a big reason why the president won Nevada, Colorado, and several other swing states. The latest exit polls indicate that President Obama won the Cuban vote in Florida, and I think that's the first time that's happened since President Kennedy. We talked about the reasons for the historic Latino vote on Thursday's show. Republicans' unsympathetic take on undocumented immigrants, Latino concern for good public education and health care, two things that Republicans, if you judge them by their words, seem to think are evil. So what's happened in the wake of the election? Well, we can already see the Republican strategy for taking back some of the Latino vote. They seem to have a two-pronged strategy. First, they intend to encourage more conservative Latinos to run for office. As a matter of fact, as voters were going to the polls on election 2012 last Tuesday, George P. Bush, the son of Jeb Bush, nephew of George W. Bush and grandson of George H.W. Bush, filed the papers required to run for state office in Texas. Various other prominent Latinos, Republican Latinos, like Florida Senator Marco Rubio and various others, were featured prominently in conservative articles and talk shows in the wake of the election. Secondly, in order to appeal to Latino voters going forward, it looks like Republicans are wholesale abandoning their ugly and regressive policies toward undocumented immigrants. Now, nowhere is this more evident than in what Sean Hannity is saying on his show about the undocumented immigration issue. After the Arizona immigration law passed in 2010 that would have allowed law enforcement officials in that state to demand state-issued ID from people, with the only probable cause being that they looked Latino, Hannity had this discussion with guests on his show.
All right, so if you listen to the pundits in the news media and you listen to news reports, you would think that the Arizona law that was passed on immigration, that this is Nazi Germany. Because that I literally spent a minute and 30 of on my radio show today examples of people using the Nazi analogy. Where are your papers?
It's ridiculous, Sean. Yeah. It's a federal crime to be an illegal immigrant in this country. So if a state wants to enforce what is a federal law with its own law, how can that be totalitarian? Why that labor?
All right, Leanne, what do we do with the people that are already broke the law, came into this country illegally, and did not respect American sovereignty?
Well, I mean, it's easier said than done, but if it was me, I'd deport them. Because they broke a law. It's illegal. It's in the Constitution, Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution.
10 million.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You can't.
Them.
And it's upwards of probably 20 million that we don't know. That's what I'm saying. You can't do that. I would deport them.
But you can't. Don't look for me for support, because I agree with her.
But they all broke a law. What do you do? Just because they're close to us and the Mexicans come in, that we should give them all a free pass?
We only have a limit.
Yes, that was Sean Hannity towards the end of that clip saying, don't look at me. I agree with her. Referring to the woman suggesting that we should deport all undocumented immigrants. Now, after Tuesday's election, Hannity had this to say on his show.
We've got to get rid of the immigration issue altogether. It's simple for me to fix it. I think you control the border first. You create a pathway for those people that are here. You don't say you got to go home. And that is a position that I've evolved on. Because, you know what, it's got to be resolved. The majority of people here, if some people have criminal records, you can send them home. But if people are here, law-abiding, participating, 4 years, their kids are born here, you know, it's first secure the border, pathway to citizenship, done. You know, whatever little penalties you want to put in there if you want, but then it's done.
Now, as funny as that reversal is, and Hannity's reversal and the reversal of most of the rest of the Republican Party is pretty funny to watch in real time. This is something that I think we should encourage Republicans to do if they are heading this way. I have to say, though, that even if Republicans put a bunch of conservative Latinos up for office, and even if they capitulate on comprehensive immigration reform, that will not win them the Latino vote. It's an improvement, but Latinos are more than about putting token Latinos up for office and immigration reform. Republicans are going to find out that Latinos want good public schools for their children and are not going to be happy with a party that shortchanges funding for education. Republicans are going to find out that Latinos are in favor of universal health care and other safety nets and infrastructure spend. A large majority of Latinos vote Democratic because they agree with our values. Latinos are hardworking, but they understand the value of education, and they understand that no matter how hard you want to work, you can get hurt and disabled, or a depression or a recession can come about and work can get hard to find. The bottom line is, we Latinos, and yes, I'm Latino, we Latinos are not going to forget the way Republicans treated the most vulnerable among us and the things that Republicans said about them. We're not going to forget that. And they continued saying those things until we Latinos sent them a message that they finally could not ignore this last Tuesday. It's going to take a lot more than throwing a few token Latinos up for office and finally doing the right thing on immigration reform to fix Republican problems with the Latino community. Also part of the reaction of Republicans to the election on economic issues, there seems to be a doubling down on their policy demands of no new taxes or tax increases. Now, I've said a number of times over the past few days that this is hard to understand and borderline insane in the face of the fiscal cliff approaching in January. The Congressional Budget Office expects that if nothing is done, the economy will contract by 1.3% and experience a recession in the first half of 2013, you know, followed subsequently by a growth rate of around 2.3% in the second half of the year. But a contraction of that magnitude in the first half of 2013 would almost certainly result in the loss of hundreds of thousands of jobs. Now, do Republicans care? I'm not sure that they do. During my Thursday show, I accused Republicans of deciding not to be Americans and adopting their party as their nationality. It looks like that is going to continue. What other excuse could you give for a group that is so into their ideology, they are willing to follow it to the point it will hurt all of these fellow Americans? Mr. Turtle himself, Mitch McConnell, said, quote, "I am not willing to raise taxes to turn off the sequester, period," end quote. Not only is that cruel, it's unrealistic. All the president has to do is refuse to deal, and the Bush tax cuts go away, and taxes are raised across the board. Republicans really only have two choices, and this is important. They can choose to give the president what he wants, and taxes are only raised on the wealthy, or they can refuse to negotiate. In effect, they can try and play games with the president, and the result will be that taxes will be raised on anyone. But that's on that. Paul Krugman noted this in his article in the New York Times, and I agree with him. The president should put out a proposal that continues the Bush tax cuts for everyone but the wealthy, and then be prepared to let the automatic tax increases and spending cuts go into effect if Republicans display an unwillingness to negotiate. That's the reality facing Republicans. They're holding no cards in this situation, And they're trying to pretend as if they have a lot of choices or power. Hey, Mr. McConnell and Mr. Boehner, you got two choices. You got two. Raise taxes on everybody or raise taxes on the wealthy. In other words, you're going to give the president what he wants, and you're going to like it. Also, as a consequence of what happened on Tuesday, Republican and conservative pundits and pollsters are trying to explain why they misread what would happen in the election. Pundits like Karl Rove, Michael Barone, Dick Morris, Ann Coulter, and several dozen others all said that the election would produce a landslide victory for Mitt Romney. They were saying this as late as the night before the election. They were saying this as late as early afternoon on Election Day. Now, the reason that they did this has to do with an old admonishment that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle used to administer via his Sherlock Holmes character. These pundits twisted facts to suit theories instead of theories to suit facts. 22 out of 25 polling organizations were telling the story that Democrats were going to turn out in large numbers, that Democrats were going to win every demographic except for straight white men and the elderly, and that the president was going to win virtually all of the swing states. Polling also showed that more people blamed George W. Bush for the economic problems than Obama. But these pundits insisted on believing that the people would blame Obama for the economy and that Romney was going to win. So they attacked pollsters whose data suggested otherwise and issued crazy prognostications about big Romney victories. These folks are now all trying to explain why they were so wrong. If you just read between the lines of what they're saying, it reads exactly like what I just said. They were convinced Mitt Romney was going to win, and they twisted every bit of factual information, the math, as the Obama campaign team called it, to fit their expectations and narrative. People should remember that this is how these folks operate. Facts are twisted to fit narratives instead of the other way around. You'll see that with Benghazi. Now, other prognosticators that got it wrong, pollsters like Mason Dixon, Rasmussen, and Suffolk, those are the three out of the 25 I mentioned earlier who showed Romney was winning, ignored what their own research was telling them to predict that Republicans would turn out in numbers equaling Democrats and that the youth vote would not turn out as it did in 2008. Slate's David Weigel noted that Rasmussen reports, which had consistently seen a fall off in Democratic Party identification, saw a close winnable race. Romney had surged into a tie in Ohio, according to Rasmussen. They had a tie in Wisconsin and a two-point lead in Florida for Mitt Romney and a small national lead. Think about that. Rasmussen had Wisconsin tied, but President Obama won that state by 7%. That's way outside the margin of error. He had Romney with a two-point lead in Florida, but Obama won that state. And he had Ohio as a tie, but President Obama won that state by 2% and 100,000 votes. Now, Scott Rasmussen took to his website to try and explain the discrepancy. And he said, quote, our final daily tracking poll showed Romney at 49% and Obama at 48%. Instead, the president got 50% of the vote and Romney 48%. We are disappointed that our final results were not as close to the final result as they had been in previous elections. He also said that a preliminary view indicates that one reason for that is that we underestimated the minority share of the electorate. He goes on to explain the percentages involved in that. But the fact is, his own research and the research of these other pollsters and pundits who missed it so badly, they all said the same thing. They all showed that minorities were energized and they were going to go out and vote in big numbers. It would be easier to accept their errors if they didn't have these other polling agencies' data to determine as well. If nearly 90% of your colleagues are calling something differently than you are, at the very least, it should prompt you to challenge your own assumptions. I don't care what industry you're in. Rasmussen, Mason Dixon, and Suffolk never seemed to feel the need to reexamine their assumptions. They never took to their websites to issue the kind of commentary that Nate Silver was issuing on nearly a daily basis, where he explained exactly what his methodologies were, why he thought he was right, but also where he could be wrong and why. There was none of that from Rasmussen or these other two or three polling agencies that got it so wrong. Now, beyond these folks, unskewedpolls.com and Dean Chambers, who runs that site, is probably the most egregious case of failed prognostication in the election. Mr. Chambers created this entire website and suite of predictions based on the idea that most polls and Nate Silver's poll aggregator organization had polls skewed in favor of Democrats. Now, I'm going to say, if you're going to do something like that, if you're going to disagree with 22 out of 25 polling agencies out there, you better be right. And if you aren't right, you should never opine on polling again. Now, in the wake of the election, Mr. Chambers issued a short statement acknowledging that he was wrong and Nate Silver was right. But that's not enough. We should never see anything from Mr. Chambers again on polling. So moving on to another topic. Now that we've won again, Democrats need to ensure that we do not get caught flat-footed again. What do I mean by that? 4 years ago, Democrats were basking in the glory of one of the most massive Democratic election victories of the last 100 years. We took the Senate, we took the House, we took the presidency. Just 4 months later, the Republicans put together a surprise in the form of the Tea Party that put Democrats and President Obama on the defensive for the rest of his first term. Now, I noted during the first 2 years of the administration, while this was all going on and I was going around giving talks, that the Republicans were in campaign mode for the entire first 2 years of the Obama administration. You can look and see what the Republican Party and conservative think tanks were spending during this time and how they were mobilizing people. I used the word several times in talks. I used the words presidential election level effort to describe the effort that was being put forth by Republicans and conservatives to oppose President Obama's agenda, and that's what it was. The Tea Party and the think tanks that supported it spent several $100 million fighting the president's stimulus and health care reform efforts, not to mention spending money and time organizing and protesting. And as I said, it worked. It made it seem like Republicans had the veto-proof majority in Congress and not the other way around. And that carried into the 2010 election and the results that we saw there. To prevent this from happening again, this is so important. If you take away nothing from this episode of Making Sense, take this away. To prevent this from happening again, grassroots Democrats need to stay organized and involved. The campaign is not over, okay? Think of it that way. The campaign is not over, and because we have to guard against another Tea Party type of trick by the Republicans, the campaign will never be over. Election Day may have passed, but the need to maintain that level of involvement is not over. Now, I want to talk about something else, too, because I think this is going to become very important. The last time a Democratic president was reelected, Republicans set out to impeach him. Will that happen this time? This is where I'm going to get into Benghazi. President Clinton, as we all know, was impeached by House Republicans but not removed by the Senate. Clinton's main sin, and this is what I thought then, and I've always thought since, his main sin was that he was a Democrat who was reelected and was perceived as doing well with the economy. Republicans don't want that. Republicans want Democratic presidents to be seen as failures, particularly with the economy. Barring that, Republicans will hit them on known issues and try to impeach them. Now, I noted with the voter suppression issue that once Republicans find something nefarious that works, they'll use it again and again until they suffer so badly from being exposed that they are forced not to do it again. The impeachment of President Clinton achieved what it was set out to do. It tainted President Clinton's legacy a bit, but even more important, it made Election 2000 close enough to steal. Without the impeachment scandal, Al Gore goes on to win the presidency in 2000 by 5 to 10 points in the popular vote and by an electoral vote margin similar to what President Obama won with this time. But that's not what happened in 2000. President Bush ended up in the White House after a period where Democrats were entirely and unquestionably successful running the country. Republicans like how that all turned out. They will try it again with President Obama if they get the opportunity. Which issue does it look like they'll choose? Well, I don't know what new issues might come up, but right now, conservatives continue to harp on Benghazi. On my last Thursday show, I talked about how Americans come together during a crisis historically. And as evidence, I offered the Great Depression, I offered World War I and World War II, and the September 11, 2001 attacks. After those attacks, Americans gave President Bush a 95% approval rating. That's the highest any president has ever seen since approval ratings have been tracked. He had an over 80% approval rating among Democrats. To give you an idea of how big that is, most sitting presidents don't have much higher of an approval level than that among their own party. Sure, we could have dwelled on warning signs missed, but we Democrats and the rest of America didn't do that. But let's talk about those warning signs for a minute so we can compare and contrast them to Benghazi. When the presidency changes hands, as it did in the beginning of 2001, there's a transition period where the Democratic policy teams, foreign policy teams, and national security teams of the outgoing administration meets all day for several weeks with the incoming teams to get them up to speed on what's happening. During the transition, the Clinton team warned the Bush national security team several times to keep their eye on al-Qaeda, that al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden were dangerous and were trying to attack the continental United States. By the way, all of what I'm telling you now came up as factual evidence in the 9/11 congressional hearings, agreed to by all sides, including the Bush administration, and this information is not in dispute. We also know that the CIA briefed Condoleezza Rice and her national security team at least three times with warnings that al-Qaeda planned to attack the U.S., and at least one of those warnings a month or two before September 11th specifically mentioned the use of commercial airliners as weapons. CIA Director George Tenet was said to be concerned that Rice and her team was not taking those warnings seriously. Indeed, there's evidence that Rice, whose only job as national security advisor was to safeguard the security of the United States, found Tenet's repeated warnings annoying, and after one such in-person warning, had Mr. Tenet and his deputy thrown out of her office. Now, think about that. The national security advisor of the United States, only job is to safeguard the security of the United States, throws out the director of the CIA and his deputy because you're finding warnings about an impending attack annoying. Over 2,500 American civilians died in the September 11, 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center in New York and Pentagon in Washington, as well as in the hijacked aircraft. As I indicated earlier, rather than harp on recriminations against what signs might have been missed by the administration, the reaction of Democrats across the United States, whether elected officials or whether they were grassroots everyday folks, was to support the president in bringing to justice those who attacked us. We Democrats were not looking for a scapegoat. We were being Americans. So let's talk about Benghazi. On September 11, 2012, four U.S. consulate workers were killed in the attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, including U.S. Ambassador J. Christopher Stevens. The attacks on the consulate seemed to coincide with anger in the region over the release of the film Innocence of Muslims, which had been broadcast on Egyptian television on an Islamist station just 2 days before the attack. Demonstrations against the film broke out in Egypt on September 11th and spread to many other countries throughout the Middle East. Now, Republicans including Congressman Daryl Issa, are trying to claim that President Obama and his national security team and State Department were negligent regarding the attack on the consulate there. As evidence, they pointed to around a dozen violent incidents in the city in the six-month period prior to the attacks. Wikipedia listed the most serious of those as, number one, in April 2012, two former security guards for the consulate threw a homemade fish bomb IED over the consulate fence. The bomb didn't cause any casualties. And just 4 days later, a similar bomb was thrown at a four-vehicle convoy carrying United Nations Special Envoy to Libya. That also didn't injure anyone. Two, in May 2012, an al-Qaeda affiliate calling itself the Imprisoned Omar Abdul Rahman Brigades claimed responsibility for an attack on the International Red Cross office in Benghazi. Three, that group released a video of what it said was a detonation of an explosive device outside the gates of the U.S. consulate on June 5th, which caused no casualties but damaged the consulate's perimeter. The brigades claimed that the attack was in response to the killing of Abu Yahya al-Libi, a Libyan al-Qaeda leader who had just died in an American drone attack, and it was also timed to coincide with the imminent arrival of a U.S. diplomat. There were no injuries, but the group left behind leaflets promising more attacks against the U.S. And number four, British Ambassador to Libya Dominic Asquith survived an assassination attempt in Benghazi on June 10th. Two British protection officers were injured in the attack when their convoy was hit by a rocket-propelled grenade. So those events that Republicans are trying to point to as what should have prompted more security, only two involved Americans or the consulate, and both of those resulted in no injuries and quite frankly seemed amateurish. This is what Republican Congressman Daryl Issa suggests should have prompted heightened security and thus makes the administration negligent. Now, this report sent in by Daryl Issa does not take into account that Ambassador Chris Stevens was extremely popular in Libya to the point where after his death, over 30,000 Libyans marched and protested his killing, holding signs that indicated that much of Libya loved Ambassador Stevens, and they demanded and got the government to disarm all militant groups in the wake of this attack. That is the story up until the attack. This does not read like a situation where the administration was negligent. The administration certainly did not have 9 months of direct warnings, both from a prior administration and from the CIA warning of imminent attack. No one in the administration threw out another member of the administration from their office for issuing too many warnings. The other thing that Republicans are asserting here is that there was a cover-up in the aftermath of Benghazi. So it would take another half hour to go through that, which I don't have, but suffice to say this. Compiling the information about an attack that happened halfway around the world takes time. In particular, understanding who attacked us and why takes more time than simply piecing together what physically happened. It appears that around 125 to 150 militants stormed the consulate and killed the four Americans and injured several others. But just on the basics, right, 125 to 150 militants could seem like a crowd protesting the anti-Muslim movement. Confusion as to who was attacking the consulate and why seems perfectly reasonable to me. On the very day of the attack in Benghazi, protests were going on in Egypt and elsewhere against the Innocence of Muslims film. Add to that the always present confusion in military and terrorist actions and the fact that it requires some time for the administration to understand that it was a deliberate and planned terrorist attack is pretty understandable. What's not understandable, in my opinion, is the Republican reaction. Actually, let me back up. I understand what the Republicans are doing, okay? The issue is that the Republican reaction is not justifiable. As I have been saying, Republicans are trying to make Benghazi into an issue that they hope can be justified for impeachment. Compare this to the reaction of Democrats after 9/11. Al-Qaeda had been an issue for half a decade. Al-Qaeda had attacked the USS Cole. Al-Qaeda had bombed the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. The CIA gave specific warnings. We Democrats were not interested in a scapegoat or to make a political issue over the September 11th attacks in the U.S. We came together as Americans to support the president's response to the crisis. Republicans, as I keep pointing out, have stopped behaving like Americans. For Republicans, their party has become their nationality. I say, bring on a fair investigation into Benghazi, preferably in the Senate, and then let's move on. Finally today, I have a return to presenting the Sense and Nonsense Hall of Fame and Shame, respectively, the part of my show that highlights those politicians and pundits who made particularly good sense or particularly bad nonsense over the last few days. I have one entry in terms of making sense, and it is Sean Hannity. Yes, Sean Hannity. I don't get to feature Republicans or conservative pundits very often in the Making Sense section, so I got to jump on it on those rare occasions when they say something reasonable. And Sean Hannity's suggestion that we should offer undocumented immigrants a path to citizenship makes sense. Fact is, we need them here. As I said on Thursday, they pick our food out in the fields. They cook and serve most of our food in restaurants, and they do that at a wage that keeps prices down for the rest of us. They occupy millions of apartments and other housing units. They pay for them, I should say, and that keeps property values up. We need them. And after needing them, not tossing them away like garbage is the compassionate thing to do. I know that's not why Sean is doing his 180 on the issue, but that's okay. We don't need him to be doing it for the right reason. We just need him and other Republicans to do it. Now on to the Hall of Shame for talking nonsense. Second worst is Mitch McConnell and John Boehner for refusing to go to negotiate on taxes with the fiscal cliff coming. Mr. McConnell and Mr. Boehner, the president just has to do nothing and the tax rate will increase on wealthy Americans and everyone else. Then the president could propose a bill that would cut taxes for the middle class and the poor, and Republicans would have to sign it. Mr. Speaker and Mr. Minority Leader, you have nothing. You have nothing to go to negotiate with here. So your attempts to make it seem like you have some sort of line that you're going to cling to on taxes is just utter and complete nonsense. But the worst nonsense of the past few days goes to pretty much the entire Republican Party, elected officials and grassroots alike. It's their continued effort to politicize Benghazi. Republicans, the enemy are the folks who attacked the consulate, not President Obama. Maybe it's time you started thinking in those terms. That's all I have for this afternoon. Thank you for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 8 p.m. Eastern this Tuesday, November 13th. Until then, have a great afternoon and a great beginning of your week.